Welcome to the Architectural History Podcast, a podcast dealing with histories of architecture in the built environment. In our first series, Architecture And, we speak to a number of academics, architects, writers and thinkers to discuss space, buildings and cities, and to think through contemporary debates and issues.
Hello, Jess. How are you doing?
I'm good, Matt. Thank you. We're here for episode one of our podcast, Architecture and we're your hosts, so we should introduce ourselves.
Absolutely. I'm Matthew Lloyd Roberts. I work at the Architectural Association School of Architecture, and I'm interested in architectural history and the way that people thought about buildings in the past.
And I'm Jessica Kelly. I'm a historian of design and architecture. I work at the University for the Creative Arts, where I teach and I also write about these things.
So this week's episode is called Architecture and Absence. And Jess, you sort of organized and led this one. So what do you mean by architecture and absence? What are we concerned with today?
That's a really good question, Matt. So the idea of this episode was inspired by Women's History Month and starting by what seems to be a gaping absence in architectural history, which is the absence of women. Or actually, more accurately, the overlooked presence of women in architecture and in architectural history. My thinking started by looking at the origins of art history and architectural history right back in the sort of 16th century with Vasari's work that was called The Lives of the Most Excellent Painters, Sculptors and Architects, which was all men. But you can trace that up to the 20th century and the history of modernism with books like Pevsner's Pioneers of Modern Design from William Morris to Walter Gropius. These histories, which are really partial, they focus on the stories of white male architects and their buildings. And they overlook a lot of the work of women architects, but also people working in other capacities in building, women working in a range of areas that constitute architecture. So in this episode, we started by wanting to think about naming those women, finding their histories, pulling them out of the shadows, as one of our speakers, Erin McKellar, described it. But we also reflected on broader questions about how we think about architecture and how we tell histories, moving beyond perhaps this fascination with individual architects who are often male, to acknowledge this broader range of people who are involved in architecture and think more broadly about what counts as architecture.
Amazing. So who are we speaking to first, Jessica?
We start with Sarah Akhavogan. Sarah is an architect and a filmmaker. She's founder of Studio Aki, which is a transdisciplinary architecture and research practice who makes socially engaged projects. She's working on a film about her search for the histories of female architects of colour in the UK. This film is called XXAOC, and we talk about how this struggle to trace the story of the first female architect of colour in Britain and how the project was informed by her own experience in architectural education and in practice. Sarah, I wanted to start by asking you if you can tell us something about the what and the why of the XXAOC project.
So what is the XXAOC? So the XX is female or women, and the AOC is architects of colour. XXAOC, female architects of colour. There are several facets to the project, but the main thing is that it's a film. The XXAOC is a film project about female architects of colour, which I set out to make because our voices are often missing from the conversation around architecture, so contemporary architecture, but also from architectural histories. At the point at which I started the film, there were only 100 Black women on the architects' register, and that's out of some 41,000. The project started as a call out online. I wanted to make this film. I'm a filmmaker, and my last film was She Draws, She Builds, which was about women in architecture. But I realized at some point that that something was missing from that film, which was these stories about female architects of colour. And so I put this call out online just saying, who are they? Whose stories should I be telling? And then that was on a Sunday morning, I think. And then I went off and got on with my day and came back and just had this amazing response. And I was really taken aback. But when I started picking through those responses, I realized that most of the figures, particularly the historic figures, were from the United States. And so I kind of wondered, you know, where are the UK architects? So in America, there is a list documenting female architects of color, kind of from one through to, I think they're just over 500 now. But we don't have anything similar here in the UK.
So, I mean, it seems like a huge question, but I suppose, could you say something about why you think these women are so absent from our architectural history?
So I think that there are a number of reasons why these women are so absent. It's to do with a general attitude towards women's work, that it's generally undervalued. Denise Scott Brown, in her essay, Room at the Top, talks about the kind of star system, the sexism that she faced, and the fact that even though, you know, she sort of repeatedly told journals and authors, you know, her office reminded these people that she was there, she existed, that in fact this was her work, she was still kind of omitted and not given appropriate attribution. So we know this already. But in terms of female architects of colour, I think the issues are even more complex. There are more societal factors at play. So there are things like the fact that women were actually denied access to the profession. So people like Amazalie Meredith weren't actually allowed to train as architects. Ethel Bailey Firman in the United States wasn't allowed to put her name to projects. So what that meant was that not only was women's work undervalued, but when they were doing the work, it wasn't attributed to them at the time, and their traces were literally obliterated or erased in the moment.
That's such an important point. I was reading something recently about changing the discourse around hidden histories in museums and actually calling them disguised histories. You know, it's not accidental that things are left out of history, and that there are active decisions made in overlooking people and their work.
There are active decisions made. There are active decisions made at the time. There are active decisions made in retrospect. There's one other I'd like to throw in, which is alongside all of this, which is about the attitude to women and people of colour. There is also something about what we consider to be architecture. You talked about Pevsner. You know, our descriptions of architecture are very much kind of wrapped or framed in this classical language, which tends to exclude societies of colour.
No, absolutely. So the other points you've put wanting to talk about is thinking about how this relates to who tells the stories, who writes those histories. And I suppose that would link into your film itself as an act of writing history. But also when you talk about Manette Da Silva and the histories that have been written about her, do you want to talk a bit about that?
There is this saying, history is often written by the victors. I would say history is often or usually written by the powerful. And women of colour often or usually aren't those who hold the power. I'm trying to redress the balance a little in terms of authorship by making this film. So I'm an architect and a woman of colour, and I don't see myself represented in the stories that we hear and are told or in the education process. And so I sought to try and kind of redress the balance a little by seeking these women and telling their stories. And during that process, I came across Manette Da Silva, whose work I hadn't heard about. I got to meet and interview Shiromu Pinto, who is the author of a new novel about Manette's life and work. And that's really interesting. Her novel's a really interesting piece of work because it kind of very much, although it's a speculation, it very much kind of outlines Manette's career in contrast to people like Jeffrey Bauer and indeed the great Le Corbusier. And you see in this contrast, you know, considering this idea of authorship and curation, how it was possible, you know, you see this process of kind of editing in and editing out, or, you know, the sort of allocation of opportunity. So of Jeffrey Bauer, Shiromu Pinto says, he could never have achieved what he did if it hadn't been for her. Yet her legacy is completely eclipsed by his. He was able to set up a trust to preserve his work, yet she never had the means to do this. She was never paid enough. She worked and died alone. And so although Manette is arguably a pioneer of regional modernism in Sri Lanka, she was largely ignored during her lifetime and is now only slowly coming to recognition. So leaving a legacy, writing history, has always been the preserver of the rich and powerful. And Manette's work very much kind of exemplifies that. And another parallel that I found interesting is kind of thinking about Virginia Woolf and her book, A Room of One's Own. She, during that essay, she kind of talks about the idea of Shakespeare's sister, Judith, who also, she kind of speculates about the structural inequalities that she may have come across during her lifetime, and the fact that those things will have meant that she did not have the same opportunities as her brother, William. And in architecture, with regard to women of colour, perhaps we could talk about Corbusier's sister, or Corbusier's half-brown sister, or speculate in the way that Shiromi does in her novel about the fact that a brown woman with equal talent existing at the same time just would not have been able to have the same career and would not be recognised in the same way and not be recorded by authors in the same way.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, like you say, because Manette Da Silva is perhaps one of the more written about female architects of colour, and it's really interesting to see how even when the lens is shifted onto her career, that there's still, you can still see the systems of imperialism and patriarchy kind of perhaps still shaping those narratives.
Representation is important. It's important because everyone should be part of the process of making our cities. And everyone's presence should be recorded. And it's not that you have to be black to make spaces for black people. It's just that the people who don't have power, I hate the term disadvantaged, but often the voices of people of colour are not considered significant in terms of just the space we occupy. You know, everyone has a right to contribute to that. In terms of the aesthetic quality as well, you know. And I think that diversity, you know, bringing in kind of diverse aesthetics and diverse references can only contribute to the built environment in a positive way. We are a multicultural society, and so we should see those references, I think, in our built environment. Britain was a huge empire that took in many, many cultures, and I think for too long the attitude has been kind of one of very much sort of looking down upon those cultures whilst appropriating them at the same time. So the British Museum is full of things like the Benin bronzes, yet architectural education doesn't refer to the ancient city of Benin, for example.
That point about, you know, anything designed from a singular perspective is going to be exclusionary. And so the importance of having a diversity of perspectives in that design process in order to create spaces that are more inclusive. But you mentioned there education, and I'm interested to ask you about that more, sort of obviously because the role of teaching history in education, but just in general, could you say something about sort of how you see things changing, how you see a potential for things shifting?
So there is this kind of lineage, this very classical lineage. You know, we start at Vitruvius and the 10 books, and then it's Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, and then it's Corbusier's Modular Man, and then it's Pevsner. And oh, there's a theme here. You know, these are all kind of white men, and they very much define, you know, they very much define the terms of reference within which architectural education is still delivered. So, you know, there is this kind of phrase at the moment, this term, decolonize the curriculum, which some people are quite antagonized by. I see it as potentially something incredibly positive. I see the idea of diversifying the curriculum only as something that's only positive and enriching. And I think that it's something that we need to do. It's not good enough for us to still be referring to this very kind of rigid canon, which not only excludes people of colour, but also, you know, women, the female body.
I mean, you described really eloquently at the beginning of this conversation your feeling of reading about the list of Black women architects in America, and the power that that has to see yourself in history can't be underestimated.
I've spent most of my career not knowing that these people existed, and there is an incredible amount of validation, I suppose, that comes from uncovering these people. And it should, I mean, why should one need this validation? That's a whole other question, but I think I won't go there. But it's just about not feeling isolated. You know, it's just about feeling as though your stories and history also matter, and that they are not lesser. You know, it's that.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That's fantastic. I liked your question that you finished on, which is that idea of, do women need spaces of their own to make work? And obviously you've got your own studio, but you've also mentioned social media as a kind of powerful space. Do you want to just say something to that?
Yeah. So again, kind of appropriating Virginia Woolf, in 1929, she talks about the idea of a woman needing a room of one's own in order to write. And if a woman needs a room of her own to write, substitute create, she, whatever her colour, also needs money and power to be remembered. We could say, in order to be an architect, a woman needs money and a studio of her own.
Wow, Sarah's work is such an interesting combination of like literary references with that Virginia Woolf quote, and then architectural practice and architectural history. It kind of blends all these different ways of approaching this question together. So, so interesting. Who are we speaking to next?
Absolutely. Next, we're talking to Erin McKellar. Erin is Assistant Curator of Exhibitions at the Sir John Soane's Museum in London, and she's researched the history of housing exhibitions and modernism. She's interested in how women have used curation as a way of being involved in architectural production. And we talked about how the Second World War was this moment of where housing exhibitions were a way in for women into the architectural profession. And Erin names some of these women practitioners, but she also shows how through exhibitions and curation and other what she calls practice adjacent work, women became involved in architecture in roles that weren't simply as architects, but in other ways. Okay, hi Erin. Can you tell us how you began researching women in architecture?
I started researching women in architecture essentially sort of by accident. I knew essentially that I was interested very much in the question of how architectural information becomes accessible to audiences who haven't necessarily studied architecture. And that sort of brought me to the question of exhibitions, and winnowing that down brought me to the Second World War. The Second World War is really interesting because women are actually very visible, but as Sarah said, they're not necessarily getting the prestigious projects. War is no exception to this. Men often are getting like big defense contracts, but within this, women sort of really sort of seize this opportunity and kind of run with it. And housing is one area in which this is really happening during the war. Women are kind of thinking about housing, how it should be after the war. And this is partly because housing had sort of long been established as the site of production for women. And exhibitions show this. Exhibitions of housing really reveal women at all levels of the process. They're sort of team leaders or sort of smaller roles as parts of teams. And this is where you get named women who are involved. But then you also have women as members of focus groups. You have women as members of sort of advisory panels where they're not necessarily given a name. Sometimes in the documentation of exhibitions, you see, and we ran this by a panel of women. And so you know that there's actually women who are in this story at all sort of, you know, beginning, middle, and end. So exhibitions in the 40s show a story really of women as makers. So we are thinking of women as architects. So oftentimes these are exhibitions where the women are designing the projects that are going on display. It's a story of women as mediators. So in this case, they're the curators. But when we think of mediation of architecture more broadly, we can think of things like journalists, as authors of advice literature, things like that. And then also women as the audiences and the users.
So can you give us perhaps a couple of examples of women who are acting in that role of makers and mediators of architecture at this time?
Yeah. So I'd like sort of to mention two such women. And these are Jane Drew and Elizabeth Mock. And I've sort of pulled them because Jane Drew is, you know, sort of a very well-known figure, Elizabeth Mock perhaps less known. But these are both women who trained in architecture and took ultimately sort of very different career paths. So Jane Drew kind of has a background that's sort of, you know, what we think of as typical for an architect. So she studied architecture. She qualified as an architect and practiced architecture. And this is sort of an important distinction to make because we will see many women who maybe studied architecture but never practiced. She did so alongside two different husbands. So her first husband and her second, perhaps better known husband, Max Fry. And these, of course, are partnerships, which are one avenue by which women were sort of able to gain a foothold in the profession. And during the war, she also has the opportunity to sort of lead her own practice. And part of her activity, not all, includes exhibitions. So we know that she led the very well-known Rebuilding Britain exhibition, which took place at the National Gallery in 1943. This was put together by the RIBA's Reconstruction Committee. And she was part of a curatorial committee, which was all men, but we do know from the sort of all the records around the exhibition that she was the one who came up with the idea. So it was really sort of her project. And she was sort of one of a team, but in a larger sense, she was sort of in charge. So that's one project. But the project that I'd really like to sort of talk about for a minute is this exhibition called Kitchen Planning from 1945. Perhaps a less well-known, less exciting maybe project, but it's the project where she really sort of takes center stage as a designer, as a researcher. She's really engaged in all levels of the project. So this was an exhibition that displayed model kitchens. It's giving women essentially the opportunity to see how post-war kitchens might be planned, how modern technologies could simplify their work, and allow them essentially to sort of look forward to the day when they could have sort of modern technologies in their house. And she researched the exhibition, she designs the projects, she wrote a book about it. This is a very interesting project because we know that it's one that's all about sort of teaching audiences about mass production. But let's talk about Elizabeth Mock briefly. So Mock, on the other hand, she's from the US. She trains in architecture. She has a husband, the Swiss architect Rudolf Mock, who did practice architecture, but Elizabeth herself never practices. But she's sort of practice adjacent for all of her career. Her sister was the housing expert and policymaker, Catherine Bauer. So Mock is very much in this position where she's surrounded by people who are practitioners and who are working within architecture, but she became a curator first, and then later was an architectural writer and a teacher. So during the Second World War, she becomes the director of the Department of Architecture at the Museum of Modern Art. And of course, we know Philip Johnson as the sort of star curator of, and head of that department. He's much better known for his leadership, but he's sort of asked to leave at you know, an awkward moment during the war because he holds these really sort of problematic views. There's another person who comes in, and then she comes in once he leaves. And under her leadership, the department really shifts its focus. So I think a lot of the times when we think of MoMA, we think of a focus on aesthetic issues. But while Elizabeth Mock is in charge, she's very much focused on housing. She's focused on how architecture works and teaching audiences about what essentially modern design can do for housing, the sort of promise that it holds, rather than focusing on modernist design as a good in and of itself. And this is an idea that really becomes clear in a very small exhibition, I will sort of underline small, exhibition called Integrated Building, which is from 1945. So this was an exhibition that she and the architect designer Suzanne Wassen-Tucker, who's now, I think, pretty unknown, but is Austrian born and trained and practiced with her husband, they put together a poster exhibition. And this exhibition showed examples of sort of good kitchen design and bad kitchen design. And good kitchen design, according to them, is really a kitchen that works. It helps women save time. It's easy to clean. It's a planned kitchen, so it's not one that's sort of thrown together ad hoc. And really critically, it's also one that works together with the rest of the house. But rather than designing kitchens themselves, as Mock had done, they're actually compiling examples. So they sort of work in the role of sort of critic curators.
Do you think there's any reason why these women architects and women curators were they being assigned or choosing to focus on kitchens and housing? Or is it the war context more than the gender context?
I think it is both. So Drew is definitely sort of given the commission, and the gas industry, which sort of is the one who's giving her this commission, very much does want a woman, because it is the sort of clout of having a woman do it. So in their advertisements, they even say that they have a woman architect researching kitchen design. And they never say who she is, because that's not important. It's more important that she's a woman. It's not important that she's well-known. It's only important that she's a woman. whereas Mock, she does other things as well. So she really is, to some extent, choosing to focus on this. But she's choosing to focus on it as a really sort of integral element of housing, which is her sort of larger overarching interest.
That's so interesting, is this sort of sites of expertise. It's also just making me think of Anne Massey's recent book on Dorothy Moreland and the role of curators, the important role of that mediating behind the scenes being really important. But you also said at the beginning that women are audiences and users of these exhibitions. So who was it that was visiting?
So we know that it's mostly women during wartime, first of all, because we just know that often the men are away. But there's also a few key ways that we know that the exhibitions, by looking at them, are aimed at women. So kitchen planning uses women in illustrations throughout the book. It sort of gives us little female figures working in the kitchen. And often you have like men outside the kitchen, like chilling, like very relaxed, not bothering to step into the kitchen at all, no thought of helping. And the publicity images of the show use similar sort of arrangements. They have women working in the kitchens, and you never ever see men as part of that. And so you see essentially an effort to make this into an exhibition where women can sort of like project themselves into that role of using the kitchens that are on display. Integrated Building is a little bit different because the interpretation that's on the panels is really sort of free of gender, but we know that the exhibition was marketed to educational institutions, and in particular to women's educational institutions, with the idea that women are the ones who need to learn about kitchens. And one of the sort of key common ground between these shows is that they're showing interiors that were gendered as women's spaces, and they don't at any point challenge the idea that domestic labor is women's work. So they are very much sort of working within the time that they're in. It is because of that that we can see these as a clear example of exhibitions that are aimed at women as audiences. I think that this is important because it speaks to a larger interest, I think, in something that's been present in architectural history lately, which is looking at women as architectural users. And looking at audiences is a sort of key issue within this because it helps us move beyond a narrative of authorship to reveal how women are sort of becoming the ones who are demanding, becoming the sort of consumer of architecture.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we're looking at women, or you're looking at women as users, as a generative thing. I feel like a lot of architectural history looks at users as, or from an architect perspective, users as problematic, as changing the design in ways the architect wouldn't have wanted.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm very interested in across the board, I think, because especially when we're thinking of women and housing, throughout history, women are the ones who are sort of occupying the house, who are using the house, who are maybe thinking about how the house should be designed in a particular way. And it's very interesting because with the exhibitions in particular, when we talk about things like focus groups and exhibition curators as sort of workshopping ideas, it's very much with quote unquote housewives that they're doing this activity. They're sort of getting feedback from the women who are going to be using the kitchens, who are going to be sort of taking care of children within the house. And so they're very interested in how it is that people actually use the spaces so that maybe they can be creating something that works a little bit better.
Absolutely. So just to finish off, can you think about or talk to us about how we can apply these ideas more broadly?
So I think we can do what many sort of architectural historians have started doing. So we can look closely at critics of architecture. We can look closely at advice literature. We can look closely at popular magazines. And we can be looking at the women who would have been the audiences for these different types of publication. But we can also keep looking at areas that are sort of practice adjacent. So areas that don't necessarily mean practicing architecture, but I'm talking about things like policymaking. We can also look at some of the more sort of unknown and silent voices, such as focus groups, which aren't necessarily visible, but are at the same time very present and are definitely driving the ideas that sort of emerge from exhibitions, from other sort of related things. And then when we look at now, I think we can think of sites that aren't necessarily valued as ones of architectural production, such as blogs, social media, and figures such as influencers, because of course, they're also driving the conversation around architecture. And I also think within sort of studying architecture, there is a lot of, I think, often desire to sort of go toward the named figure with an archive as a sort of easy way of getting material. But often we find these sort of smaller names, and of course they don't have an archive attached to them. But what we can do is name them, and we can evaluate the work that they produced, even if we can't necessarily ever know what part of the work that they did. I think just sort of naming them and pulling them out of the shadows is almost enough.
I love the photography that comes out of those sort of exhibitions. I've seen a lot of the photographs, but never really thought about who was doing the design work and who was constructing and making these projects for these big exhibitions. It's such an interesting subject and a way in to access some of these questions. Jess, who are we speaking to next?
So our final speaker is Elizabeth Darling, who's a reader in architectural history at Oxford Brookes University. and who has a particular interest in modernism and gender. And Elizabeth has written really widely about the history of women in architecture. But in our talk, she makes a really interesting argument for forgetting the architect, which I think is such a powerful concept with which to approach architectural history. So, Elizabeth, a lot of your work around this centres on the figure of Elizabeth Denby, and I think you're going to talk about her today. But can you tell us, firstly, how you got started with this work and also kind of what you hope to achieve with it?
For sure. Yeah. I think what I came to realise I was trying to do when I started really working as an academic historian and researcher was, on the one hand, just being more historical in writing about architecture, because I think as you try and practice architectural history, and you, particularly if you work on the 20th century, you realise how what has been written is tied less to a concern to document, contextualise, explain, understand how and why a building or a debate about architecture has come into being, and has very often been concerned with justifying a particular approach to architecture, usually modernism, and usually defining that as the antithesis of a traditional style-derived architecture. And I think in so doing that, I realised that lots of people were not forming part of those histories, or non-histories, as we might call them, ahistories, and I wanted to write a more inclusive architectural history, and part of that was sort of complicating our idea of who designs a building, how a building is designed, and even moving beyond the building as a primary concern, and thus the architect as a primary concern. And I'm also really concerned increasingly, as I'm sort of in the last sort of quarter of my career, it really bothers me how uninclusive the practice of architectural history is, and how undiverse architectural history is, and who gets the jobs and who doesn't. The discipline is very white, it's very male, and it's very middle upper class. And I'm increasingly wanting to do something about that.
So Elizabeth Denby, tell us a bit about her and what her story reveals for you.
Denby was my way in, really, to rethinking history. And it's a really good example of what I call how things which are in plain sight are often not seen. I think so much architectural history and life in general is not seeing things which are there, even though it's flaming obvious that they're there, which really annoys me. So I kind of had a very classic training. I did a BA in art history, although it was the new art history that still had a kind of canonical side to it. I then did a master's in architectural history when I was told feminism wasn't really a very big thing in architectural history. But really coming out of my BA in art history, I was very interested in the kind of idea of women and art and women in architectural history. And like a lot of people, I think I started in what is the typical way of thinking about how women and architectural history might intersect, which is I want to find the women architects. I want to do that reclamation thing. And at the same time, I was also interested more widely in social housing and in modernism in Britain. And as part of that, fairly early on in my master's course, I think I came across the building, which is really fascinating, Kensal House, built between 1933 and 1936. It's at the top of Ladbroke Grove. It's still there, just by Sainsbury's. And it's really one of the most canonical buildings in British modernist architectural history, because it's social housing, it's modernism, and it's before the Second World War. So when I first came across Kensal House, I was looking at it in its original coverage in the late 1930s versus who it was attributed to in the history books that I was reading. So if you read history books about Kensal House, or you did in the early 90s, it was almost invariably attributed to Max Fry. But if you go back to 1937, when most of the journal articles about it are published, it actually has a very interesting credit line. And it was typically attributed to, and I quote, "a committee of architects, Robert Atkinson, C.H. James, G. Gray Wernham, E. Maxwell Fry, brackets executant architect, Elizabeth Denby, brackets housing consultant. And what I realised was that despite this long list in plain sight, no one had ever really thought about what that meant. You know, why that long list of names? Why is one of them called an executant architect? Why are they all men except the one at the end, who's called Elizabeth Denby? And she has this qualifier, housing consultant. So two questions kind of came to my mind is, you know, somehow all of she and all those other names had been erased from the attribution of Kensal House. And she was also the only woman. And she also had this phrase, housing consultant. And I was very curious about that. You know, what's a housing consultant? Who was Elizabeth Denby? Blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I did a little bit of sort of rootling around. And as is so often the case, and it's a bit like with Jane Drew and Minette de Silva, these are people who are actually relatively present as names. So Denby does get mentioned, even if she's erased from Kensal House. You know, she's mentioned in a literature. But no one at that point had really thought, well, what is a housing consultant? Why in 1936 is someone involved in that role? And in that credit line, as I came to realise, having researched her, because I then went on to do my PhD about her, you know, it really embodied the two significant things about how architecture works, I think, and how architectural history works, and how those two things often intersect. The first was the absolute unthinkingness of a way of talking about the design of architecture that focused on the single protagonist as sole agent. And that single protagonist is white and male. Secondly, it made me realise that it spoke to that idea of architecture as something produced solely by architects, people who have a professional training and have letters after their name and have been to architecture school. So the architect as they come to be constituted in the 20th century, pretty much in the Western world. And Denby's gender disrupted that, but also the fact that she had no specific professional architectural training. And that seemed to make her problematic. It's really interesting how two of the most well-known male modernist architects of the 20th century in Britain, Wells Coates and Serge Chimaev, neither of them have professional architectural training. There's never any debate about them as architects, whereas I've been told by several architects, male and female, that, you know, Denby isn't an architect. So what Denby kind of made me realise studying what she did, how she did it, why she did it, was that she's a figure who is a very polymathic figure. She's multi-skilled, you know, she writes about housing, you know, she's primarily a housing specialist, but she also writes about design, she writes about smokeless fuel, she writes about all sorts of things. She serves on committees, she writes books, she's the second person to win a Leverhulme research fellowship in 1932. She writes the very famous book, Europe Rehoused. She, you know, she gets the commissions for pretty much Kensal House and Sassoon House, which precedes it. She designs a model house and a housing estate for the 1939 Ideal Home Exhibition, yet she's not a professional architect. And she drew attention, just as Erin has been pointing out, that women function in all sorts of ways in creating, using, mediating architecture. And if you're thinking about women in architecture, there's a finite number of women who we can understand in the 20th century definition of the phrase, and that it's more productive, I think, and more representative of how the built environment actually functions to think in terms, not just in the 20th century, but looking back to women as clients and patrons, as funders, as movers and shakers. I'm doing some research at the moment on Scottish women and their involvement in urban and social reform in the early 20th century. And I have one woman, you know, who, like Erin's people, are very hard to, you know, there's no archive, there's nothing. But I can find her in lots of places, and she's the money woman. None of these projects, you know, she's a big backer of Patrick Geddes, the most overrated urban person in the 20th century, possibly less, maybe just under Le Corbusier. She's the one who's funding it all. And that's Eliza Soane paid for all of John Soane's stuff. Women are there.
Absolutely. I've got a few podcast ideas now, thank you, on an episode of the most overrated people in architectural history. We'll have you back for that one. But I think what's interesting about what is coming out of what you're saying is how, like both Sarah and Erin were saying, the importance of naming people, the importance of finding people and undoing the disguising, undoing the removal of people. But what you're showing is how by doing that, you do end up actually calling into question these ideas of authorship and of the singular protagonist, that those, it almost sort of leads into that unavoidably. But I wonder if you could just reflect for a bit on what you think the tensions are in this, your approach, in the approach we're talking about in architectural history.
I move around the fence on this one because I do think there is a tension, and there is, I do get frustrated with the idea, concerned about the idea of simply adding to the canon. You know, Griselda Pollock said this in 1987, you know, is writing a feminist art history the same as adding women to art history? I think it's not the same. And I think anyone who engages with a discipline like history, which actively others people, whether they're people of colour, whether they're people of a different sexuality or not male, you know, there is on the one hand a very understandable desire to name those who are othered, and to draw attention to them and to make them visible, even when they're standing there. At the same time, unless you do something more profoundly epistemological, unless you really sort of say, well, let's try and do this differently, and that's what I've tried to do. So in my work, so although, you know, I've done books called Suffragette City, Women, Politics and the Built Environment and so forth, and I, you know, co-curated the exhibition, I've also tried in books which aren't ostensibly about women, like my first book, Reforming Britain, which was very much an attempt to do that recasting of history, and to write a much more complicated history of modernism, and to do it on a model where the architect was decentered. So although I did talk about the architects of named buildings and very canonical buildings, because I was very deliberately trying to recast how we talked about those buildings, but I was very concerned in my methodology to understand those buildings as process and to understand those buildings as created, if you like, on a continuum from the ideas around those that made those buildings come into being in the first place, many of which were generated by women, by the women who might have been involved in them as clients, as people who provided money, like Mrs. Sassoon, and right through to the way all of these projects were mediated and talked about and used in advertising or by the architectural press as a way to promote modernism as the discourse for 20th century architectural practice. So in my head anyway, I was trying to write a different type of architectural history from what I had been taught.
I mean, that's really is a case in point, because I used to live just down the road from Kensal House, and I had absolutely no idea about Elizabeth Denby's involvement with its design before I heard that. So that is, I mean, a case in point of how women's contributions have been written out of our general understanding of the built environment.
Amazing. Matt, you've just proved the point of the episode. That's it, we're done. We've talked.
Nothing more to see here. Nothing more to see here.
But it's so true. I think in this episode, what we've done is try and look at those overlooked stories of the women working in architecture in an attempt to rebalance the histories. And I think what all of our speakers have shown is the importance of representation in histories, but also of the experience of women in architecture and in architectural history.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for such a long time, these stories have been overlooked or not thought about, but it does feel like a lot of progress is starting to be made towards some of these questions. I mean, this episode of a podcast isn't going to fix these problems, obviously, but there are people doing such amazing work, and I think addressing these absences. And I think it is a really exciting time for architectural history to try and start to redress some of these, well, absences, as the name of the episode implies.
Absolutely. And the Society of Architectural Historians are working towards that with the Women's Architectural History Network. And there's lots going on. Check out the website for things that are happening.
And if you're interested in other work that tackles these questions of absence in architectural history, you can follow the link in the show notes to the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain website, where lots of resources have been gathered, lots of writing that addresses some of these questions and problems in the discipline.
So thank you to Sarah Akibogan, Erin McKellar and Elizabeth Darling.
Yeah, and we will see you next time on Architecture And.
This podcast has been produced by the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain, SAHGB. Established in 1956, we're the leading subject association for architectural history in the United Kingdom. Our educational mission is to promote architectural history inclusively to diverse audiences. Our mantra is all places, all periods, all welcome. We promote knowledge through learning, education, and research. We disseminate that knowledge through programming, content, and publications. And we advocate for the discipline and our members. To find out more about our work and to support our educational mission, please visit our website, sahgb.org.uk, or follow us at the SAHGB on Twitter or on Facebook. We are open to all. This podcast series has been created by Jessica Kelly, Matthew Lloyd Roberts, and Neil Sashore. The series is produced by Frontier. To find out more about them, visit frontierpodcasts.com.